So the scene is Minneapolis, November 1933. The truck drivers and helpers who make up the Teamsters, the local Teamsters branch, Local 574, find themselves in a union of 75 members and falling. The union is run by a team of pro-business bureaucrats whose desire to keep the bosses on side runs so deep that not only are they averse to strikes, outside of a few key coal yards, they actually refuse to even recruit. So needless to say, conditions are some of the worst in the country. So jump forward 8 months or 9 months to August the following year. Through a series of three massive strikes and a rebellion on the brink of a really all-out class war, Local 574 forces the trucking bosses to recognise their union and sign collective union agreements. The union now has total control of the city streets. They have some 6,000 drivers on strike. They have tens of thousands of workers from other industries striking and rallying in solidarity with them, donating money, donating food. Local 574 has cohered an army. They have 7,500 picketers, 450 cars, 16 motorcycles, 2 aeroplanes, and a huge strike headquarters. In these headquarters are housed a garage and workshop to keep the vehicles running, a kitchen that feeds thousands of strikers and their families every day, a hospital staffed by sympathetic doctors and nurses who have essentially donated their time to help look after hundreds of beaten and bullet-ridden strikers, and a huge hall and courtyard where the membership of 574 has mass nightly meetings to plan their actions, to respond to the manoeuvres of the bosses and the lies of the mainstream press, and even to boost their morale with live music and live entertainment. Most importantly, though, none of this is under the control of some far-flung, anonymous, distant union officials. It's all under the direct sole authority of a democratically elected 100-person strike committee, who, more often than not, are in direct defiance of the national officials and the state officials. And while rank-and-file solidarity and determination is what welds this army together, what gives it its hardness and its sharpness is the leadership provided by a handful of revolutionary socialists from a small Trotskyist organisation, the Communist League. So this is the story of how that small group of Marxists transformed Local 574 from an ineffective bureaucratic rump into a rank-and-file controlled fighting machine, who not only won recognition for their union, but whose actions shook the entire country, who won a historic victory over one of the best organised and most hostile wings of the US ruling class, and Marxists were central to that victory. So let's start by painting a bit of a picture of Minneapolis in 33 or 34. This is no easy place to be a union activist. And mostly, this is due to the activities of a powerful employers' organisation called the Citizens Alliance. Throughout the 20s and into the 30s, the Citizens Alliance has squashed every strike in the city and pretty much squashed every kind of major outgrowth of or political organisation of the workers of the city. The aim of the Citizens Alliance was to ensure that Minneapolis remained an anti-union open shop town, and they pursued this aim absolutely ruthlessly, with hardly a whimper from the union officials in the American Federation of Labour. The Citizens Alliance consisted of around 800 employers and other ruling class hangers-on, so bankers, lawyers, factory owners, department store owners, and, you know, well-to-do, you know, best family in town types who like playing polo. But it was a disciplined and class-conscious combat organisation. It ran and financed its own private spy agency to identify labour radicals. It had close ties with the city police and the National Guard. It demanded that its members sign an oath of allegiance to the aims of the Citizens Alliance, and it organised boycotts of employers that it saw as being too soft on unions or workers. So, for example, the local banks, whose bosses were all managers of the alliance, would essentially cut off funding to those employers. They'd rather drive those businesses out of business than allow the unions to get a foothold in Minneapolis. Now, the result of all this was that by the early 30s, Minneapolis was an open shop town. It was 100% open shop town. It was described by one observer at the time as the worst scab town in the Northwest. And the working class, of course, paid dearly for this. Throughout the 20s, wages had risen across the country by an average of 11%. In Minneapolis in the same period, wages had only risen by 2% or less. So once the Great Depression hit, workers seemed really in no position to defend themselves in Minneapolis. By the end of 33, the unemployed and their dependents accounted for almost a third of the city's population. For those still working, this situation just put further downward pressure on their wages and forced people into taking longer hours. So while the average wage for a labourer in the US in 1933 was $20 a week, drivers in the Minneapolis trucking industry would receive between $12 and $18, and that was for a week that was between 50 and 90 hours long. But 1933 also brought, not just in Minneapolis, but across the country, signs of a budding upturn in class struggle. After 5 years of being beaten down by the Great Depression, workers across the country were starting to fight back. And at this time, there was a handful of Communist League members working in the trucking industry. Now, their presence there wasn't an accident. As early as 1928, the local Communist League had been seriously considering the possibilities of organising in the industry. And in 1930 or 31, several key militants from the Communist League had started working as truck drivers and in the coal trucking industry. These were people like the Dunn brothers, Ray Grant and Miles, all three of them notorious militants. People like Carl Skoglund, the veteran Swedish Marxist who had been such an effective agitator in his homeland that he'd essentially been blacklisted and forced to move to the US to find work. Now, their organisation, the Communist League, had been founded just a few years earlier, in 1928, and at the outset of their intervention into Local 574, they had, in Minneapolis, 40 members including some sympathisers. But what they lacked in size, they made up for in experience and, being a core of hardened working class activists trained in class struggle. Now, the trucking industry was important in Minneapolis, especially the coal trucking industry, which is where this started, mostly because of the freezing winters. So given the freezing winters, given the upsurge, the kind of increasing combativity of the working class, it seemed to the Communist League like the winter of 33 to 34 would be a golden opportunity for some organising. So the revolutionaries approached this with thorough planning and a clear-headed assessment of the situation. Farrell Dobbs, who was a leading activist and who literally wrote the book, which I'll talk about in a second, explains. He says, "To drive the point home, it was important to show to Minneapolis workers in the opening clash that a strike in Minneapolis could be won." So the Communist League members had been agitating on the shop floor for a long time, pushing for a union, making the argument for the need to organise, to stand up to the bosses, and to try to change the ridiculous policy of the 574 leadership. With the help of two better members on the seven-member executive of 574, they managed to overturn 574's anti-recruitment policy, and so the stage was set for a determined organising drive led by the Trotskyists Ray Dunn and Carl Skoglund. The first thing they did was initiate a volunteer organising committee, aiming to bring in rank-and-file members into the process of building the union in the new yards that they were going to be organising. So the committee brought in new activists and started compiling a list of demands that included union recognition, which is actually the starting point for the whole thing, union recognition, increased wages, shorter hours, penalty rates, and job security. The first challenge they ran into was actually just holding on to the recruits. The membership swelled massively, and the first thing the officials did was try to manoeuvre to stop them taking a strike vote. So they got around that eventually. A lot of the fiery new activists tore up their membership on the spot. "This is ridiculous. I joined this union because we were going to fight," and actually tore up their membership. It was up to the members of the Communist League to actually go around from yard to yard, having arguments with those people. "You only come back, you can't just walk out. We need, we'll never have a fight if you leave. You've got to come back." They managed to force a strike vote to be held by calling a mass meeting on a Sunday, which they reasoned would be less likely to have the organisers and the officials turn up. Apparently they like having their weekends off. So they did that, pushed through a strike vote, And the membership voted unanimously to give the bosses 48 hours to recognise their union and meet their demands or face an all-out strike. Of course, the employers stood firm, backed up by the might of the never-defeated Citizens Alliance, and presumably thinking this will be just an easy victory over some naive upstarts. So they stood firm, and the coal drivers struck on February 7th. Within 3 hours, they had shut down 65 of the city's 67 coal yards, and they sewed up the coal deliveries for 3 days in the midst of a freezing Minneapolis winter. The strike illustrated the importance of flawless planning and ingenuity and the determination of the rank-and-file strikers. So the strike committee had drawn up maps, they'd planned out, they'd targeted particular yards, they'd drawn up maps for picketers, and they knew exactly where the trouble spots were going to be. So they had detailed plan, detailed with military precision. In the event, it was the rank-and-file drivers who came up with what became the tactic that became the hallmark of the Teamster Rebellion, which was the cruising picket, where any truck that actually did manage to leave a yard full of coal would be chased by pickets in cars, cut the truck off on the road, don't let it go anywhere, and if you needed to, dump its load right there in the street. So it was really, the planning might have made the victory possible, but it was that sort of ingenuity of the rank and file that made that victory, in a sense, total. They shut down the streets. So faced with this sudden challenge to their control of the streets, the coal bosses relented and agreed to a 25% wage increase and a loose commitment to recognise the union. This was the first strike that had won in Minneapolis in decades, since before World War I. This strike was built from below through arguments on the shop floor and a concerted effort to encourage and involve workers themselves, despite the hostile attitude of the union officials. In fact, when Teamsters National President Daniel Tobin, who's a scumbag whose name will pop up numerous times in this history, when his letter denying them authorisation to take a strike, when that letter actually arrived, it was 2 days after the strike had won and the workers were already back at work enjoying their victory. But as we'll see, this opening skirmish between 574 and the bosses hadn't resolved the issue of union recognition. And this was what became the central focus of the struggle in coming months. Now, with the success of the February strike, the Communist League activists immediately started looking to spread the struggle and to push towards making 574 an industrial union for all trucking employees across the city. Plans were developed for an even bigger strike. All over town, local 574 badges began popping up, and militants began pushing to recruit outside of just the coal drivers. 574's voluntary organising committee now became a bit of a mechanism for bypassing the union bureaucrats. So in the victorious atmosphere in the wash-up of the coal drivers' strike, a mass meeting of 574 members voted to recognise the voluntary organising committee as an official body, and that gave them a degree of legitimate authority with which they could use to counter the conservative influence of Tobin and the Teamster officials. The organising committee brought together all the best militants from the February strike. It expanded quite massively in this period, and the Communist League members dominated politically. The committee focused on doing grassroots organising and recruiting. Teams were delegated to go and visit workplaces and recruit to the union. In addition to recruiting, they held meetings with workers to formulate demands. And the sorts of demands that were raised give you a feel for the terrible conditions the drivers were operating in. Just two of them, for example. That workers not be liable for loss of or damage to merchandise. And get this one, we demand regular brake tests at company expense. So you compare this to the way that our unions usually operate. When we're so often organised around these mild, sort of eminently respectable demands handed down from on high. By contrast, the revolutionaries who are now running Local 574 didn't care about respectability, didn't care about saying, what will the bosses let us have with minimal fuss. By contrast, their attitude was, how do we raise the self-activity of workers? How do we involve them in organising themselves, in formulating their own demands, and fighting for these demands themselves? So in essence, how do we raise their understanding of their own power? It's this approach explains how the revolutionaries in the Communist League were able to so thoroughly express the feelings of the truck drivers of Minneapolis and to lead them to victory. So to kickstart the process of building the next strike and forcing union recognition, the Voluntary Organising Committee called what they described as a monster mass meeting. As the flyer for the meeting made clear, the aim was to open the campaign to organise all Minneapolis drivers, helpers, filling station attendants, and platform men. At this Monster Mass meeting, the key speaker was the state governor, Floyd Olson. Well, he was supposed to be the state governor, Floyd Olson. And it was the Communist League members in the organizing committee who had pushed most strongly for this. They knew that Olson had a mass base of support among workers. His membership of the Farmer Labor Party and his track record of verbal radicalism had given him a real degree of authority and support. This is a guy, for example, who, when he was elected, said, "I'm no liberal, I'm a radical." He said he supported the strike and he was prepared to donate money to the 574 strike. So he had this degree of authority. Now, this was bound to become a barrier to the workers' ability to organise and wage an independent struggle. But this was a barrier and a loyalty that couldn't just be broken down by words alone. The Communist League knew that Olson had to be drawn into the struggle if he was going to be sort of exposed and the workers broken from him. So having Olson on the platform would guarantee a huge turnout while at the same time forcing him to go on the record of supporting the strike. Now, we sometimes assume that, you know, politicians are dumb and we like to refer to them as being dumb or whatever, but Olson clearly indicated, you know, his actions indicated how clearly, acutely aware he was of the trap that he was sort of heading towards. So he did everything he could to kind of wiggle out of being involved in this meeting. So the organising committee ran a pressure campaign and forced him to accept their invitation to speak at the meeting. In the event, the Monster Mass meeting was monster. It was huge. Olson, even though he'd accepted, didn't turn up, but he was forced to send his personal assistant down to speak on his behalf and confirm that, yes, Governor Olson supports the strike. So he pledged Olson's support for 574. Skoglund, Dobbs and two of the Dunn brothers, all from the Communist League, they also spoke on the platform of the mass meeting, and by now they were all making a name for themselves among the rank and file. They made fighting speeches and outlined a clear line of battle, including, first and foremost, an all-out strike if the union's demands weren't met. So more people signed up on the spot, pushing 574's membership up to almost 3,000, and the proposed course of action, as laid out by the militants of the Communist League, was voted up. The meeting also voted to establish a strike committee of 75 people, including the CL members. Over the next few weeks, the strike committee organised for war. They established and staffed those headquarters that I referred to earlier with the kitchen, the hospital and the garage. They drew up picketing squads and plans, and they put each squad under the command, or we had a sort of organizational structure really akin to military field units, with each one of these little battalions of picketers under the command of someone who'd been a veteran of the February strike. They also collected money from supporters and from other unions, gearing up for the fight ahead. But one of the most important things that the revolutionaries did in this period was to find local 574 some allies. And in this, it was the organisational links of the Communist League that proved essential. So to counter the potential of the mass pool of unemployed being used as scabs, they brought in support from the unemployed movement, where Communist League activists had already been playing a leading role. So there had been rallies of tens of thousands of unemployed people fighting for the right to work, fighting for better welfare provisions in the preceding 12 months. Communist League activists had been central to that. And so it was very easy to bring that support across. 574 also adopted demands that were raised by the unemployed workers and actually set up an unemployed workers sort of division of 574. They also established a women's auxiliary. In an overwhelmingly male industry, this was an attempt to stop spouses and partners of the workers having their morale kind of chipped away through a long period of hardship that they themselves would have had really no control over. So bringing them into the struggle and giving them a degree of, ownership, as they say, ownership over it, was the aim there. Women went on to play an important role in the following two strikes. So in the struggle overall, they played a very important role, and not just in the kind of stereotyped areas. You know, they were right in the front line, involved in skirmishes and clashes with the police and the special deputies. Many of them were hospitalised, so they were right in the front line as well. The Communist League explained the rationale for the auxiliary in simple terms. They said, "The exploiters are organised to grind us down into the dust. We must organise our class to fight back, and the women are half of the working class. Their interests are the same as ours, and they are ready to fight for them." The third thing the Communist League did here in terms of shoring up allies was they used their connections with an organisation called the Farmer Holiday Association to win the support of as many of the local farmers as they could. So 574 rented out a big car park, and they gave small farmers from the association permission to come and sell their fruit and veg there direct to the consumer. You could bring in a carload and sell it direct to the public. This kept the farmers happy, and it also cut out the big markets, the big trucking firms, the wholesalers, the supermarkets, etc., who were the true targets of the truck drivers. So meanwhile, the Citizens Alliance were also preparing for battle. The crunch came when they started to brazenly go back on their earlier loose agreements about union recognition. They started refusing to deal with the union. Now, this was just the spark that was needed. So in response, the strike committee called a snap meeting for May 15, where a massive turnout of members voted to strike. And promptly, they set about implementing the battle plan that they'd been refining in the previous weeks. The thoroughness of this planning undertaken by the strike committee was even noted by the pro-business paper, the Minneapolis Tribune. The day before the strike began, they reported, "If the preparations made by the union, for handling it are any indication, the strike of truck drivers in Minneapolis is going to be a far-reaching affair. Even before the official start of the strike at 11:30 p.m. Tuesday, the general headquarters set up at 1900 Chicago Avenue was operating with all the precision of a military organization." So you can get a picture of the sort of vibe that's starting to build up towards this strike. So by dawn on the first day of the strike, it was clear that this was an overwhelming success. The Minneapolis streets were brought to an almost total standstill. And it wasn't just coal trucks this time. It was every trucking company that had refused to recognize the union. Newspapers, groceries, even taxi drivers joined the strike. The only drivers still at work were those in the fields where union contracts already were in place, so namely milk, ice and beer. Everything else was struck. Almost immediately, the strikers were faced with a huge increase in the level of repression. The cops and the Citizens Alliance special deputies launched a spate of violent attacks on the cruising pickets, with many being hospitalized. A number of traps were set up where fake scab trucks carrying practically nothing would be used to lure pickets into confrontations where sort of thugs who'd been hiding on the wings would come in and beat crap out of them. In many strikes over the preceding years, strikers across the US had been beaten and shot and killed. So given that sort of immediate history, you might have expected in the face of this violence the workers of 574 to retreat. But something had changed, and these strikers responded to the violence by spontaneously arming themselves, intending to match the police and the deputies club for club. All through the night, the headquarters buzzed with strikers making improvised clubs and helmets. They were joined by volunteers from the Carpenters Union, who were so outraged by these attacks on the strikers that a whole bunch of them came down to strike headquarters and volunteered their skills in club making. A group of picketers even hijacked a truckload full of clubs that had been made and was supposed to be delivered to the Citizens Alliance. They hijacked the truck, took it to strike headquarters. So clearly all this was upping the ante. The Communist League activists were now influential enough to restrain this activity had they wanted to. And perhaps if it had started a few days earlier, they might have. But in the current climate, this new context of self-defense against violent cops, it seemed like a perfectly sensible act, and they predicted that it would no doubt have broad support even beyond 574. They also pointed out that through this process, the workers of 574 were starting to realize for themselves the role of the state, the side that the state takes, and the sort of force that the state is prepared to use against workers. So the strike committee developed plans to push this situation further. And their chance came outside the market a few days later. This time it was the strikers who set a trap. A few dozen pickets were placed at the market, but 600 more were secreted away across the road, and 900 more were down the street at strike headquarters. So the scab trucks arrived, and they came accompanied by several hundred cops and special deputies, clearly looking, for a bit of a lark to beat up some workers. One guy apparently turned up in his jodhpurs and polo helmet, this ruling class goon who just thought he'd have a bit of a laugh by beating up workers. So the cops started it, they punched a picket, and suddenly all hell broke loose. To their horror, the cops and the deputies found themselves surrounded by hundreds of picketers who flooded into the markets in military formation and took to them with clubs. Most of the deputies ran away, and for 3 hours the cops and the pickets fought it out until the cops withdrew and not a single scab truck moved. In a fantastic reversal of the usual story that we'd seen time and again in those previous years, this time it was 37 cops who were hospitalised and only a couple of strikers. At this point, support for 574 jumped dramatically. The increasingly violent behaviour of the cops and the courage of the strikers led many workers in other industries to demonstrate that support publicly. Rank-and-file members in the city's usually quiet construction and building unions voted to walk out and stay out for as long as 574 was out. Again, the presence of revolutionaries in those unions proved instrumental. For example, it was two members of the Communist League who led their union, the Electrical Trade Workers Union, from their workplaces to the 574 strike headquarters to place themselves at the disposal of the strike committee. The battle at the markets resumed again the next day, and it was even more heated this time. Thousands of strikers faced off against thousands of cops and deputies, but this time the fight lasted just 1 hour. First, the deputies were given a hiding and driven from the area, and two of them later died from their wounds, which is nothing compared to the number of strikers who'd been killed over the previous decades. And for good measure, the cops were driven out of the whole area and driven out of the vicinity of strike headquarters. And in that whole region of the city, it was picketers who were doing things like directing traffic and running the region. So in a situation where the cops are losing control and the city's workers are refusing to buckle, the government, you know, felt forced to intervene, or they saw a chance to intervene, and to intervene more directly. So Governor Olson was drawn into showing his true colours, and he put the National Guard on standby for what they call strike duty, which, as we know, would be more, you know, better called strike breaking duty. And the strike committee immediately denounced him, demanding that he withdraw the troops. And in the face of 574's growing influence and growing support, perhaps Olson realised that he was risking his support base. So this time, he backed down and demobilised the troops. But as the Communist League activists hastened to point out, this was a sure sign of things to come and proof of why Olson couldn't be trusted. Eventually, on the heels of a huge multi-union rally, the bosses signed an agreement to recognise the union, and this second strike ended after 11 days. But of course, the Citizens Alliance still weren't beaten. Within a few weeks, they were already up to their old tricks, refusing to recognise the union or fudging around the definition of what that recognition was supposed to be. The key issue now was they said, oh, no, 574 is only allowed to cover drivers. You don't cover anyone else, not the helpers, not the clerk, not the clerks, not anyone else, the filling station attendants, none of that. So that was, as the strike committee pointed out, because this was a finding by the Labor Board, the Labor Arbitration Board, and so 574 pointed out, well, thanks, you've just given us the right to represent at least half our membership, or almost half our membership, because all those inside workers had joined 574 in droves. So it was clear that 574 was running headlong into another confrontation with the bosses, and this time they weren't prepared to go halfway. They wanted real victory. So in preparation, the still convened strike committee established a strike bulletin called The Organiser. This was to be printed weekly at first, though it switched to a daily edition once the strike began. With a readership stretching into tens of thousands, the paper was to become the central means through which strikers were armed with the arguments and analysis needed to respond to the ever-changing situation and the constant lies and machinations of the bosses and the press. The Organiser was essentially coordinated by the 574 fraction of the Communist League through their central role in the strike committee. It was the Communist League itself that took on political leadership of it. The paper's political line came from discussions among party membership in the branches, or in the branch, and the paper's and the leading party members, national leadership, James Cannon and Max Shackman, actually wrote for the strike bulletin, actually using assumed names. The cops tried so hard to kill this paper that eventually the strike committee had to set up armed picketers to guard the last printing shop in town that was still prepared and willing to print it, because the cops had tried to smash it up so viciously. Local 574 at this point also reached out to the rest of the union movement, who had been energised by their struggle. A mass labour rally was held on July 6 under the slogan, Make Minneapolis a Union Town. Tens of thousands of workers marched in union contingents, and speakers from various unions pledged their support to 574. The rally endorsed the resolution that 574 had the right to represent its members and demanded that the bosses sign an agreement to this effect by July 11. Immediately, Daniel Tobin, that scumbag, the national president of the Teamsters Union, turned on the 574 leadership, launching a vicious smear campaign. This was to be expected, of course, but by now the revolutionaries had both a practical authority and they had this the means with which to sort of wrest some of the official authority from the bureaucrats. So at that July 11 meeting, Local 574 once again elected a strike committee, this time of 100 people, and again including all the Communist League activists, but they also endorsed the strike committee's proposal that all seven members of the 574 executive be put onto the strike committee, and that strike committee become the executive with sole power to make decisions in the course of the strike, effectively rendering the executive board irrelevant. They were powerless for the duration of the strike. The meeting also voted up a two-person, what they called a contacts team, rather than a negotiating team. This way, all the decisions on whether to settle or in what terms would be brought back to the strike committee and the membership, rather than having a couple of individuals empowered to just make the decisions and call off the strike or make concessions on their own. The two people elected for this role were the Communist League members Ray Dunn and Farrell Dobbs, and they gave the federal mediators absolute hell. As a Communist League veteran recalled some years later, they never negotiated 2 cents out of the Trotskyist leaders of Local 574. They got a dose of negotiations and diplomacy which they are still gagging from. We wore out three of them before the strike was finally settled. We despised them and all their wily artifices and tricks and their hypocritical pretenses of good fellowship and friendship for the strikers. So the third Minneapolis Teamsters strike began on July 16 and lasted for 5 weeks. It had a bigger impact, obviously, than the May strike and brought the most brutal state repression yet, immortalised in what became known as the Bloody Friday killings of July 19. On that day, without any warning, dozens of cops opened fire on a group of unarmed pickets. 67 people were shot, including a handful of bystanders and even a police sergeant, which gives you an indication of the frenzy that was going on. There's this frenzied shooting where they even shot their own sergeant. All those shot were unarmed, and most were shot in the back, is what the finding of the coroner was, of the surgeons was later. And many of them were clubbed about the head while they lay bleeding on the ground. The lives of two pickets, Henry Ness, a striking worker, and John Bellor, an unemployed worker, were taken in cold blood. This slaughter changed everything. Minneapolis was cleft in two, with the city's working class rallying to the defence of 574. Solidarity strikes swept like wildfire across many industries. And even those unionised drivers, milk, ice and beer, who I mentioned before, even those drivers walked off the job and threw themselves into the struggle. Large sections of the middle class were drawn in, donating money, food and resources to help. And on the day of Henry Ness's funeral, some 40,000 people lined the streets of Minneapolis, and not a single cop dared show their face. In an editorial, the organiser responded by addressing itself to the murderous cops and their masters in the Citizens Alliance, and they wrote, "You thought you would shoot Local 574 into oblivion, but you only succeeded in making 574 a battle cry on the lips of every working man and working woman in Minneapolis." While support for 574's struggle had grown massively, the members of 574 themselves were also leaping forward in their understanding of the situation and the state and the struggle that they were engaged in. Their earlier instinctive attitude of taking up clubs to defend themselves against cops was echoed this time with much more serious ramifications. In the days after Bloody Friday, many strikers turned up at headquarters with guns, but this time the revolutionaries of the Communist League had to disarm them. This was not the time for attempts at insurrection. Taking up guns against the cops, even in this climate, would have isolated 574 from the rest of the city, let alone the rest of the country. The governor or the president would no doubt seize the opportunity to send in the troops, and in all probability it would have resulted in a one-sided bloodbath. But taking guns from hundreds of angry strikers who have just had two of their comrades murdered isn't easy. It was only possible in this case because the Communist League activists who took responsibility for it did it on the ground and had won the authority and leadership on the ground to be able to do that. Farrell Dobbs was one of the people there on the day and had to take those guns, and he described it in his book, which was 40 years later, as still the hardest thing I've ever had to do in my life. So in this tense atmosphere, Governor Olson saw the opportunity to decisively break the strike, and he called in the National Guard to restore order. He argued that this action was neutral, suggesting that it was aimed at neither the union nor the bosses. Now, undoubtedly, there would have been some number among the strikers who probably believed this, so the organiser answered it directly. They said, "We never called for the National Guard, the employers did. We call for their withdrawal. We don't need the National Guard to stop scabs. The employers need them to convey scabs through. Bayonets, tear gas or trench helmets cannot move trucks. You need truck drivers and helpers and platform men and inside workers to move trucks." Olson's intentions were quickly exposed. In slowly climbing numbers, he granted military permits to trucking companies, allowing them to have scabs on the streets under military protection. Then, on April the 1st, the National Guard raided strike headquarters, and they arrested most of the leading strike figures, including the three Dunn brothers and Bill Brown, the 574 president, who was one of the better, clearly better members of the executive, and went on to spend the rest of his life sort of in the orbit of the Communist League. All of them were thrown into a military stockade. But this attempt to kill the beast by lopping off its head failed, because the rank and file, now schooled in managing their own fight, pushed forward a new generation of leaders, a new round of leaders, who took on the strike committee role, and no momentum was lost. More industries were struck. The arrested leaders refused to negotiate while they were being held in a military camp, and despite the troops, the picketing of the scab trucks continued. Eventually, after a rally of tens of thousands of workers demanding that the 574 leaders be released, the government was forced to release some of them. It actually held others for the duration of the strike in hard labour conditions in the military stockade. The conditions were abominable, but the prisoners organised and improved their conditions somewhat. So by this stage, a war of attrition was now underway. Life was getting unbearably tough for the strikers after 5 weeks, and 574 was starting to find resources and money wearing thin. But with no profits flowing in, it was the bosses who crumbled. Individual employers started breaking the discipline of the Citizens Alliance and offering to sign union contracts. Eventually, the Citizens Alliance leadership buckled and settled the strike with guaranteed full union recognition for Local 574. At a mass meeting on August 21st, the members of Local 574 declared victory and voted to return to work. Almost immediately, within days, workers in other industries followed 574's lead, in Minneapolis but also across the country. The victory in Minneapolis was one of three significant wins for the US working class in the year of 1934, and that year proved to be a turning point. Struggles by auto workers in Toledo and longshoremen in San Francisco played out along similar lines, with rank-and-file workers defying the law and the state and their own union officials to set their own agenda and fight for it themselves. In each of those three cases, the strikes were led by small, organised groups of radicals and revolutionaries committed to rank-and-file control. As historian Sidney Lenz explained, the upturn in class struggle of 1934 coincided with the growth of the radical left. He writes that, at that time, one or two leftists among 1,000 workers was enough to give the group direction and stimulus, and there were plenty of young leftists around. A new generation, active at first in the battles of the unemployed and then in the plants, talked openly of revolution as though it were the first order of business on the historical agenda. In Minneapolis, the Communist League provided that leadership, and it grew itself in the process. Many of the militants in the 100-person strike committee joined or moved into the orbit of the Communist League, including the then 25-year-old Farrell Dobbs, who became a leading figure in American Trotskyism and in the country's labour movement. After the strike, the Communist League went on to merge with those radicals who had played a similar role in Toledo, and sort of laid the basis down the track for the forming of a significant Trotskyist organisation, the Socialist Workers' Party. Today, Marxists like us here operate in an environment not entirely different to those of the revolutionaries of 574. Once again, capitalism is in crisis, and the revolutionary left finds itself as just a tiny element facing entrenched union bureaucrats who have presided over years of plummeting membership and done nothing to resist the attacks, we'll hear, that the Labour government is pushing. And again, millions of us work in casual, seasonal or short shift type arrangements, while a pool of unemployed stands like a silent threat. Of course, there are differences too, and significant ones, but the point that I'm trying to make is that the lessons of the Teamster Rebellion are timely and relevant. Marxists in the unions fight for rank-and-file democracy and organisation, not for official positions, but for independence from the bureaucracy, and we fight for class struggle strategy, not for class collaboration. We fight for the creation of a politically cohered militant leadership on the ground. The Teamster Rebellion demonstrates the success, it vindicates this strategy, and it proves the importance of these politics. I wanted to finish with the words of the organiser, the Daily Strike Bulletin, published on their front page under the big banner Victory, the day that the settlement was announced. They explained the importance of the leadership and the ramifications of the strike like this. They said, "Local 574's historic struggle has become a national affair. Minneapolis has shown the country something new, and newspaper front pages everywhere carry our name. What was new? Not the fact that a few thousand workers, miserably oppressed and exploited, rose to rebel. That happens daily. Everywhere, American workers, sick of working like slaves and living like bums, are striking. The pity is that, as a rule, they are cheated, betrayed, or sold out by those they trust and rely on. The bosses crush them, or their leaders betray them, or they get caught in the national runaround of federal mediation. They tried all of that in Minneapolis, but it was no go. That's what was new about our strike. That made the whole country sit up and take notice. Every means of oppression was brought to bear. They shot our pickets down in cold blood. Two of them lie dead today, victims of the murdering, union-hating conspirators, martyrs to the cause of labour. They flung our pickets and our leaders into a military stockade. They raided our headquarters, but they couldn't break us.